Okay, so hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Fall Global. This is where we connect with global first entrepreneurs and remote work experts from all around the world to share their experiences. Our guest today is Taylor Cloutier, founder at Clockwork Labs. Taylor, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Sure. Taylor, it is fantastic to have you on the show. And with your journey from senior data science engineer at Machine Zone, then founder at Skylab, and now at Clockwork Labs, could you maybe walk us through your career journey that led you to where you are now?
Sure, absolutely. So just to kind of give you a background on my education, originally I majored in chemical and biomolecular engineering, which is not really relevant to computers. But at the same time, I had been taking a lot of computer classes. And ultimately, I got my master's in distributed systems and machine learning. And then from there, I interned at Bloomberg, which was very interesting. Could tell you some stories from there about what they were working on. And then I took a job at Apple and came out to the West Coast. The job at Apple ended up being not really what I was interested in, and I had a friend that worked at a company called Machine Zone, which was a mobile gaming startup. I think it was about 500 people when I joined, and it was in their data science department, and that was very interesting to me, especially at a fast-growing startup. So I hopped over there. In that place, we worked on developing the big data platforms to actually process all of the user data, and then build them into models. So we would want to estimate, for example, how much money is this person likely to spend based on their initial behaviors? How likely are they to churn? How much revenue can we expect from them? Do they like the game? That kind of thing. So it's very, very interesting to build those kinds of systems and have, we built a reinforcement learning system at some point to choose which tutorials actually worked best. And then after Machine Zone, I had wanted to do a startup for quite a long time. And my co-founder of Skylab at the time was someone I had worked with at school and then also at Bloomberg. So he ended up going full time at Bloomberg. And we had an idea for a startup, and we went and we started it. We actually had a third co-founder for that company. And at Skylab, we were making research software for grad students. So namely, what you can think of is basically GitHub, but instead of needing to know the command line and dealing with Git and all that, you could use it through the website and upload all of your big data. So Git doesn't generally deal with big data. And in this case, we were. And then you could run Python scripts on top of that data. So it was a sort of lab notebook, an auditable lab notebook, with the ability to run code and then build on your data. It was a super cool product. It's actually still up at skylab.io if you want to check it out. We have some people who have their PhDs in there. But ultimately, when you go to an investor meeting and you say that you want to make software for grad students, their eyes kind of glaze over, and it's not exactly the most buzzwordy thing around. I still think it was a great product, and that we could have done something very cool with it. The initial idea for Skylab, just to give you some background, was to make an automated laboratory. So something where you could write a program to actually have a wet lab experiment carried out by robots, and the results then returned to you. Because most wet lab experiments, you really only care about the data at the end. You don't care about the actual product. That was not within our means in terms of capital. So we started with the lab notebook. And then sort of towards the end of that, we were bootstrapped the entire time. We never raised for that. We actually changed the name of the company. So it's still the same company. Clockwork Labs is still Skylab. We had been working on a game in the background. And that game was inspired by my time at Machine Zone. That game ultimately became Bitcraft. To give you a very short version of that. Bitcraft is an MMORPG where the idea is we want to put all the players into a giant survival crafting game where they build civilization up from the ground. And so they'll need to work together. It's all the players. So we put, maybe hundreds of thousands or millions of players in a single physical world. and have them work together to rebuild civilization. In the process of developing that, we also have built a very interesting back-end technology to be able to support that game. So that's just a very, very quick run through of my career history.
Okay, sounds cool. And let's talk a bit about Clockwork, sure. Clockwork Labs. So as far as I understood, Clockwork Labs focuses on building this massively multiplayer societal games, right?
That's right.
So you're prioritizing social interactions over combat, right? As far as I understood. So could you delve deeper into this concept of societal games?
Certainly. So let me first contrast what we're building with the sort of the prototypical MMORPG. So a lot of MMORPGs get their sort of ancestry from games such as World of Warcraft. There, it goes a little further back beyond that. But that's the one that most people are familiar with. And in those games, the way it works essentially is that the primary player progression through the game is focused around combat. And so very briefly, you kill a bunch of monsters, you go up in level, you get to the end of the game, and you fight more monsters or you fight each other in PvP. And that is the normal progression of the game. For a game like BitCraft, we wanted to focus on a lot of the elements in MMORPGs that people really love and that there's a huge audience for, but that get relatively less focus than in those types of games. So what I mean by that is activities like crafting, building, and creating, trading, socializing, farming, fishing, those kinds of activities. And so in BitCraft, we built the progression around that. So it really is around building a civilization together with other people. And what you find is that those elements of those games are very popular and people love doing these types of activities. And they also make it so that more people can collaborate with each other at the same time. So if I'm level 3 and my friend who joined 3 months earlier is level 50, we can't really do the same combat activities together unless they erase their progression or give me fake progression so that we're at the same level and that we can actually participate together. That's how the scaling in those games work. Whereas in BitCraft, a player who is brand new can certainly help out another player to build or create a thing or to go gather low-level resources to be able to put them together to build a town. And so that's just one way in which players of different relative progression can work together and collaborate.
And I'm just curious, how do you encourage this social engagement and cooperation, right? And that's first question in those type of games. And the second part of it, I guess, what differentiates them from traditional this multiplayer games?
Okay, I'll answer the first part of the question. So the question of how do you encourage people to actually work together is a very interesting one. The first way that you would do it is you would make the things that people want to do. So for example, build a very large ship or build a really cool city with walls and roads and everything. You make that really hard. And then the second part of it is, and you make it progressively hard. So it doesn't start out really hard. You can build a thing yourself, no problem. But the more ambitious and grandiose the society you're trying to build, the more difficult it becomes. And the second thing is that you set up the progression in the game to be something that encourages players to specialize. So for example, if I get more reward for going deeper in the mining skill, or really deep in the woodcutting skill, then I would kind of broadly going across all of those skills, then I'm encouraged to keep going on the path that I've already chosen or that I like to do. But then, in order to build the types of things that you want to build in the game, you need to work with someone who has equally focused in another skill, because you might need both woodcutting and mining to build the building that you want to build or the wonder or whatever it is that you're trying to construct or create in the game. So those two things combine to do that. And could you remind me of the second part of your question as well?
And the second part, what differentiates those type of games from traditional multiplayer games?
Societal games, you mean?
Yeah.
So I think the main thing is that you are fundamentally working with other players against the world rather than sort of alongside other players. So in a lot of MMORPGs or even multiplayer games, you are theoretically in a multiplayer game, but their impact on you is actually not that large, right? So you might be mining alongside somebody else, but if the economy doesn't support you getting a benefit from other people mining things or trade or anything like that, then it doesn't provide you any real tangible benefit other than there is a person over there that you can look at while you're both mining for yourself, if that makes sense. So that's a really big component of this is the interconnectedness of the economy and the world.
And you know, another part, probably the same question, the third part of it, with every game, the final, I guess, goal is to win, right? So you should kill everyone and you're the winner, right? In societal games, can you really win something?
So it's a great question, actually. And I think it gets to a part of the game that we haven't really talked all that much about, which is, so I guess there's two parts to this answer. The first part is you can, of course, when people come into a survival crafting game or a game like Minecraft, right, you can't win at Minecraft. This doesn't make any sense. But what you can do, people come into these games.
In Minecraft, you can reach the final stage. Yeah,
that is correct. You are right. In survival mode, you can do that. But there's a lot of other things that people do in Minecraft that are completely unrelated to survival mode in this case. But that's a great point. They've sort of added into the traditional game progression after the fact, after having a game that people enjoyed for its survival and crafting. But when somebody comes into a sandbox like that, typically they have an idea of something that they want to create in that world. And that is really what BitCraft is primarily about. It's about providing a social sandbox where people can get together and put together the sandcastle that they envision in the world. So what we've seen in the past is people will build giant monuments like a pyramid. People will build roads that cut through mountains. And they have to put in an enormous amount of effort to be able to do this kind of thing. They can set up trade routes and all of that stuff. So that's the first part. The second part of like what is the motivating factor for people playing in the game is that just as in a game like RuneScape, there is this progression. So getting to the end of the progression or sort of maxing out on all your skills is another driving factor for players. So we have these types of goals in the game that are internally set by the player, and we also have these external goals that players are given by the game where they say, like, hey, you can get to level 99, you can become a master woodcutter or whatever it is. And then we can get pretty fancy with those goals. So one of them, for example, is to control an empire. So an empire is a thing at the end of the game progression, more or less, where you can take resources from the game world and you can build out basically a skin on the map where you say your empire is, and you get to determine certain things within the borders of your empire. And there's rules about how others can challenge your empire and so forth. And so there is an element of PvP at the end of the game, but it is not, I am going to go kill you. It's more like we are going to strive in an economic struggle to have the map skin, if that makes sense, where I get my name up there for all the world to see. So these are the sort of driving factors for
yeah, this. Yeah, totally makes sense. Totally makes sense. And I know that one of the projects that you're currently working on, and you mentioned this, the Space-Time DB, right? So
that's right.
Can you tell more about this and how does it help in building games like BitCraft?
Yeah. So first, I'll just say briefly, what is Space-Time DB? So Space-Time DB is a system whereby you take the logic of your program and you upload it into the database in WebAssembly, and then your clients connect directly to the database. So BitCraft, the game on the server side, is only a module, we call them, a WebAssembly module that you upload into SpaceTimeDB, and that is it. What is the purpose of this? Well, if you want to make a single-player game, it's very simple to make a single-player game, relatively. You just know Unity or you know Unreal, and you go to town. You can make an arbitrarily complex single-player game. if you want to take the simplest single player game and make a multiplayer version of that, well, now the amount of technologies that you as a developer need to know and maintain goes up dramatically. So you need to know like Docker and Kubernetes and AWS or some cloud service and S3 and networking and web servers and game servers and databases and network synchronization and all of that, all the goodness that comes with that. And so it basically is completely intractable for indie developers to make multiplayer games of any particularly complicated consequence. And you see that as a pattern. So like Minecraft, for example, was originally an indie developer game. And it's multiplayer, but they leave it to you to run. They say, like, you're going to run your own server. Or Valheim, same thing. Like, you got to figure out how to run that on AWS because we're not going to do it for you. It's too complicated. There's too much state involved. It's a pain. And so what Space.db does is it takes the back end, the multiplayer aspect of it, and makes it just as easy as something like Unity. You basically have Unity, or you have Godot, or you have Unreal, and you have Space.db, and that's it. So that is, in a nutshell, what Space.db is. And there's a lot of other cool things about it as well.
And speaking about talent who are basically building those technologies that you're talking about, for those guys, for tech talent who are interested in contributing to the maybe right. development of societal games and maybe who want to become a part of your team, what skills or even mindsets do you believe are crucial considering this unique, I guess, challenges and goals that you have?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I guess the first thing is, as is perhaps evidenced by me being on this podcast, we do hire globally. So we hire, we have people anywhere from California is the furthest west and India is the furthest east. We typically don't go beyond eastern Ukraine because of time zones, but we have an exception in India at the moment. So the types of talent that we look for really are specific to the two products that we have. So for example, in BitCraft, one thing that we have found very powerful about hiring globally is that we can pick up an indie developer who is putting out really amazing content on social media and just offer them a job and say, hey, here you go. We can bring you on, start whenever. And that's the kind of talent that is not going to be located in a single place. And we find that indie developers have the right mindset for developing a startup game because they not only think about their little piece of their engineering work, but also the product as a whole and what impact their work has on that product. So that's, I would say, for BitCraft. And then on the Space.db side, we look for, it really depends on the type of thing that we're trying to do, but we look for sort of specialist talent or people who are interested specifically in this concept of Space.db, which there are people, they don't sometimes realize it's so similar, but then they come and look at it and like, oh, okay, I get this whole thing. This makes total sense. So we've hired someone randomly off of a Hacker News forum based in Colombia. We have hired people from Sweden, where we hired actually a Rust developer who's based in Sweden, so someone who works on the Rust language itself. And that's the kind of sort of specialty skills that we look for when you're making a database, which is it's quite an esoteric art form to make a database. It's also very hard, by the way, to Google for. You can't say, I would like to hire a database engineer, because what you're going to get is a bunch of people who use databases,
yeah,
not people who build databases.
And speaking about that, then what strategies from a practical perspective does Clockwork Labs employ to attract those top talent from different parts of the world?
Yeah, it's a great question. So one thing is that, I mean, I think the primary thing is that we have a very cool set of products. We have two that are unique in their respective fields. So the unique thing of BitCraft is that these kinds of MMORPGs, I mean, there's a handful of MMORPGs that are being developed at any given time. And then of them, this one is quite different because it's a sandbox MMORPG where you can mess around with the sand in the sandbox. That's been great for attracting indie talent that wants to work on something a little bit bigger than what they have currently worked on. And then I would say on the Space TinyDB side, we can pretty much nerd snipe people into working on something that has a lot of cool new technologies. We're working on Rust, we're working on WebAssembly. But not only that, we have a bigger dream for developing applications in general, that you shouldn't need an operations team of five people or and a DevOps team and a whatever team. You should really not need to deal with that to be able to do that. So that's been, I think, what has attracted people to our company.
Okay. In speaking about culture, you touched this a bit. Startup culture is key, right? Especially in gaming. So I have seen this firsthand working with different game studios all around the world, and where like a big part of their hiring is about finding the right cultural fit, guys, right? So with that in mind, have you set up any special efforts to make sure your hiring is inclusive and culturally like a sensitive?
So we certainly have. It's very interesting hiring across the globe because people have had a lot of different experiences. You know, we had someone who grew up in East Germany, which is quite a bit of a different experience from where I am. One thing that we offer, which I think has been very helpful, is that we have two paths when somebody interviews for a company. One is to just go the normal interview route, which is typically what people choose if they have if they already have a job at the current moment, because it's sort of the standard path. The other one is we will just offer, after sort of one initial interview, to do a month working with that person and skip the interview process. And so we've been able to find talent that you might not otherwise find because you just don't have to go through the whole interview thing, or maybe they don't interview well, or whatever the reason is, and we can work together. And you get a very good sense of someone's working style and if their culture matches the company during that time. And likewise, they get to find out if they like the project and the company and the culture. And that has been very successful for us for making sure that we're bringing on people who not only believe in the products that we're making, but who really add to the culture of the team.
And I guess on a different note, I'm curious about your perspective on the current trends in the gaming space, in the tech space in general, particularly with this recent layoffs, right? So how do you see things evolving in 2024?
It's a good question. I would say I'm not an economist. I think the recent round of layoffs is holdover from 2020. The pandemic, where two things happened simultaneously. Everybody stayed inside and played video games, and they printed a lot of money. That together means that people raised a lot of money, and their people's expectations were much higher than where it ended up being. And that naturally, just through the, if they're not printing more money and people aren't playing as many games, it's going to be the situation for the world. And so we were quite thoughtful about that, and we quite intentionally kept our burn rate low through that period. And we're going into 2024 in a very strong position relative to a lot of other game companies that had sort of, cool, we're going to go out and hire everybody and we're going to burn this down. You know, I think we had an incredibly small team when we raised our last round, and that's a key part of it. How it is going to advance in 2024 is hard to say, difficult to predict. I think it'll begin to normalize. So fewer layoffs, but I don't think it's about to go crazy or anything again. That's kind of the landscape that I see. I think it's going to be a more like a 2019 landscape in 2024.
Okay. And probably my last question, what future goals or developments do you see specifically for Clockwork Labs?
Well, the thing we're focused on right now is shipping two of our products, the only two products we have. So that means Bitcraft. Bitcraft is currently in pre-alpha. We've done upwards of 11 pre-alpha playtests with players we let in by random chance or sort of choosing people who have done certain things on the survey. And then taking that game from pre-alpha and bringing it to alpha. So we've announced the alpha. The alpha is going to be the first version of the game, not under NDA. So it'll be really interesting to see what the community's reaction to the game is. It's going to be a lot more players, and I'm super excited to see. It's going to be a longer playtest as well, and I'm really excited to see how that's going to go. That is early 2024. The other product we have is Spacetime DB. So Spacetime DB, we announced it's out there. It's in beta. You can try it out. I highly recommend it. We're updating it all the time. We're going to be doing an overhaul on the website documents too to make it even better and easier to use. Definitely try it out. If you want to build and deploy an application in it, you can do that. The thing that we haven't done is right now we have what we call the testnet. So the testnet is basically our cloud service that we provide that allows people to deploy, like one-click deploy. Hey, it's gone. It's up there. It's free to use, but it also, we wipe your data periodically. So it's not something you could deploy a production application on. Our next milestone there is launching the mainnet for SpaceTimeDB, and that'll be the first version where you can deploy your application. Your data is going to be there forever. We have an SLA, and we'll start charging money for it. The pricing is very similar to AWS's in terms of the amount of money that it should cost you to run an application. So we're really looking forward to that. And that'll be sometime around March. That's when we're targeting that.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks so much for joining us today and for sharing your insights on this innovative concept of societal games at Clockwork Labs, on your approach to attracting global talent in the gaming sector. So, yeah, we wish you and everyone at Clockwork Labs all the best in your exciting journey.
Thanks so much. You too.